Hi there. Welcome back to the Real Film Chronicles podcast. As always, I'm Nathan.
And I'm Brian.
And in this week's very special episode, we're going to be taking a look at a little film called Event Horizon.
Yeah, we're traveling all the way back to 1997 to revisit what has become a cult film, really, right?
We'll say a cult classic.
That's it.
Cult film could be like, oh, this could be a great film that many people love that's kind of a niche film, or it could be like a recruitment video for a cult, I find. There's like some ambiguity there.
True. This is a regular film. This is a Hollywood film about a haunted spaceship called the Event Horizon. And, you know, it came out very mixed reviews. I shouldn't say mixed reviews. It came out and it bombed, okay? Not well received, but over the years, it has gathered a lot of folks behind it. The average ratings, I think, have gone up and people are appreciating this thing. And we're seeing bits of it, like some influences in other films throughout the years. But I just want to read the little plot synopsis description here from Letterboxd first before we get into it. Give you a little plot outline and possibly some spoilers, because these things are sometimes spoilery. In 2047, a group of astronauts are sent to investigate and salvage the starship Event Horizon, which disappeared mysteriously 7 years before on its maiden voyage. With its return, the crew of the Lewis and Clark discovers the real truth behind the disappearance of the Event Horizon and something even more terrifying. Pretty spooky stuff.
Yeah, I love the timeline on this movie, because by this point in human history, we're supposed to have our first permanent colony on the moon by now, right?
Yeah.
And we're also having like manned missions to the mid to outer planets, so like Neptune and Jupiter. So their predictions were a little bit off, but it's interesting to go back and see, like, in the 80s and 90s, you know, how those predictions would pan out. It's like, oh, first, because back then it's like, oh, we were on the moon in, what was it, 68 or 69 was the moon landing, the first moon landing. It's like, oh yeah, it makes sense that, you know, like looking at the timeline, like, oh, we went from horse-drawn carriages to the moon landing in less than 50 years. Like, we'll have a colony on the moon in another 20, 30 years. No problem, right?
Right. It's kind of a tragedy. It's like, we don't really go back to the moon in real life anymore, but like movies and stuff. No, we're going back to the moon. We're colonizing. 2015 is the year they colonized the moon in this movie. I wrote down the date 2032. I think they might colonize Mars or something. But in 2040, the Event Horizon is launched, and this movie takes place in 2047, so 7 years after that initial ship launches. And where does the Event Horizon go? Out to Neptune?
Yeah, so we've got less than 20 years to invent a mode of transportation that literally opens a wormhole across space and time. So those scientists at NASA, you got 17 years. The clock is ticking here, guys.
I just want to say, like, they have this mission. The Lewis and Clark is this mission headed up by Captain Larry Fishburne here, Lawrence Fishburne.
Good old Larry Fishburne.
Good old Larry. And this point stands out to me because we just released, at the time of the recording, our episode on 65, where we're kind of talking about like the cryopods and how long their journey was. And it's like, I think they said this trip from Earth to Neptune on the Lewis and Clark was like 55 or 58 days long, maybe 68. It was essentially 2 months, 2 or 3 months. And they're in what I think they call them grav pouches, but they're essentially put into like a cryostasis for that trip. And we're thinking back then in the movie 65, it's like 2 years was kind of dubious as to wanting to be placed in cryosleep.
Okay. So I was watching it again. It wasn't just cryosleep. It was really interesting. It was also to protect them from the G-forces of the acceleration of their engines. That's why they were in liquid. And I thought, oh, it actually doesn't make sense, because like forces are actually multiplied through liquid. So it's like it actually, you'd probably be liquefied even more. But I was like, that was interesting that they were thinking about that. It's the same thing like in Star Trek, to get really nerdy on the listeners here. But like when they talk about inertial dampeners, that's the technology that, you know, prevents people from being pancaked when they accelerate past, you know, 0.5 or, you know, 6.5 times the speed of light, which if you accelerate that fast, you'd be, you know, your bones would be pushed out of the back of your body, right? But like, in Event Horizon, like they were actually, even though like the technology is kind of dubious, they were actually thinking about, oh yeah, we're going to be accelerating pretty quickly. And I think they mentioned at one point, it's like, hey, if you're not in the pod, it's going to like liquefy your bones. It's like every technology in this universe, in this alternate history is utterly terrifying.
The movie is terrifying, and it really is like a horror film right from the outset, right?
Yeah.
Like,
so going through, what was your first experience with Event Horizon? When did this first come on your radar, Brian?
You know what? I probably did watch it back in the late 90s. It was probably like a video on demand rental, or like going to Blockbuster and picking this thing up. I definitely did not see this in theaters. It was just kind of like one of those sci-fi movies that, you know, I go out of my way to find back then. And then you get kind of, it was different. It wasn't just like alien in space. It was demons and horrible things happening. It was kind of a neat take on it up to that point, because sci-fi was kind of like clean. Like, we were watching Next Generation and stuff and Star Wars, right? It's just like, there's like a cleanliness to that. This one is more akin. I think there is some inspiration from Alien. And I know Paul W.S. Anderson talked about how he wanted to differentiate from Alien, like the franchise, and make it a little more like supernatural. And I think that really played well for the movie. But I think that's probably why I fell in love with this. Like, what about you? Do you remember the first time you watched this movie?
Vividly. Discovered this thing? This movie scarred me for life, and I love it dearly for that, due to that fact. I was babysitting my little cousin. He's not little anymore. He's an adult with a family and a job, which is really weird to think about, seeing all these little kids around you grow up. But anyway, he lived like technically next door to us, but my uncle, his driveway is like half a mile long. He lives on a farm. So he's literally got like telephone poles down his driveway to get power to his house. Like, it's a long drive down there. So like, we lived out in the bush, but this was like really isolated. And my uncle had satellites. We didn't have satellites. So once my cousin was in bed, I was flipping through the channels. Found, oh, there's this sci-fi movie. Event Horizon, started watching it. In the dark, in the middle of the bush, like literally no other houses around or anything, like that sense of total and complete isolation watching this movie scared the living daylights out of me. And it was burned into my brain ever since. Like I can't quit this movie if I tried. It just came along at that time in my formative years, and it was frightening, and it was disgusting and sickening, and yeah. I couldn't look away.
Right. they definitely employs like a lot of these quick cuts, and like you can't process what you're seeing sometimes, especially I think in that like hell orgy scene, that like the infamous one that people want more and more of.
Oh, and he gives him the vision of like, this is what, like, because the whole thing, like, I guess spoilers, we've already spoiled the whole thing, but
yeah,
the whole thing is like, it's been to like the drive, the propulsion drive was opened a wormhole. It's supposed to like transport them to another galaxy, but apparently it took the ship to an alternate dimension of pure chaos and pure evil. And at one point, one character who's overtaken by the evil Sam Neill's character, he puts his hands on Lawrence Fishburne's head and gives him visions of this place. And it's all of him and his crew being tortured. And there's a sadomasochism to it. I was watching the special features, as it sounds like you were as well, Brian. And he kept going through his influences. And I'm just like, say Clive Barker's Hellraiser. Say Hellraiser. Just say it. Paul Anderson, he just didn't say it. It's like Hellraiser was really an obvious inspiration for this. Just say Hellraiser. I was getting angry at my screen because like Alien, and I was like, Stanley Kubrick 2001. Just say Hellraiser. It was an obvious inspiration. Why won't you just say it?
Yeah, that's funny.
But all like the sadomasochism and like Sam Neill when he, he gets taken over by the evil force, because like the ship comes, the whole conceit of the movie is the ship comes back and it's, you know, quote unquote alive. It's just, it's merged with this evil malevolent force, and it's alive. It's like the way it's, you know, attacking people and giving them visions. It's almost like an immune system. I think somebody described it as one point. But one thing throughout the movie, it's just completely, it's one of those things that always gets me. But everybody who gets possessed by this evil, one of the things they do is they seem to like gouge out each other's or their own eyeballs.
Yeah, yeah.
All the time. There's a recurring theme. And at one point, Sam Neill's character is possessed by this evil. He succumbs to it. He rips out his own eyeballs and he stitches his own eyelids shut. But he can. But he still has this weird sense of sight. Like he can still see, right? He's still got these senses. And just the whole thing is like he's got stitches all over his face and like the orgy scenes, like in the alternate dimension. And at one point he gets blown out into the space, but the ship won't let him die. And he comes back and it's almost like stitches over his body. Like he was like reassembled and he reassembled completely buck naked, but it was like, oh man, it was just terrifying imagery, like hellfire, but also mixed with the sexual imagery. It's just like, yeah, it's obviously inspired by Hellraiser, but it's got its own unique twist. We got not just like, obviously kind of like the gothic kind of alien design, like literally from the movie Alien, but then like the walls and the bridge, and like I can't believe they never cleared this off, but it's like all blood and guts and gore and bones and skeletons and stuff like on the sides when like the original crew went crazy and killed each other. It's truly, yeah, it's horrific. Like just looking off into the side, I was like, this is really just, the whole set is just horrific. Like being there every day, like I know it's different when you're on the sets, it's not as scary, but like just the way the gore and everything was done up and like how poorly lit. Like you must get creeped out walking to the set like this, right? Like you can't not.
And like they did a really good job with those sets. Like that type of decoration was really detailed. And yeah, you're watching behind the scenes stuff and you're like, when it's all lit up properly, like it looks janky. But when it's done in like that, when they film it and they apply the filters to it, everything looks really, I think it looks really neat. And I think the practical sets really go far. And I think, in one of those behind the scenes features, he talked about the design of the ship itself. Yeah. It was a church, like quite a famous church.
Like Notre Dame.
Yeah. It's kind of like put on its side, and just kind of like spacified a bit. And it's just like, oh, this is like the religious imagery is here and it's going to be, I mean,
yeah, I thought that was really interesting.
Building on its side is a little subtle. You may not pick up on it, but like you're going to pick up on the architecture, like you said, the gothic architecture of that stuff. Like you're going to recognize that on a subconscious level at the very least.
Yeah, like the use of archways, and I think like the way he would put like in the sick bay, I think they had the glass set up as like, oh, it's like almost like stained glass in a cathedral. But also like that engine room, it looked like it was designed by Cenobites, right? Like
the spikes on the walls there. Totally.
Like that looked like it was that like if the Cenobites, the evil entities from Hellraiser, if they were going to design a spaceship, an engine room, that's what they would design. Cause like it was like weird spikes everywhere and like spinning things. Like it just looked like you go in there, like this is a death torture chamber in here. This isn't an engine room. It's a torture chamber to kill people. Like it's completely ridiculous design, but it works in the context of the movie. We think like no engineer would design this unless they were already possessed by some evil force, right? Or like creating some kind of, hell gates, to steal a term from Buffy.
Right. I'm glad you mentioned that Hellraiser. I didn't put that together before, but as soon as you said that, I was like, oh yeah, I'm thinking immediately of all the, like the weird skinless suits and stuff they wore, I think in Hellraiser 2. And it's just like the effects, the people look very similar to that. And I kind of wonder if maybe some of the crew and whatnot were involved in both of those movies in the 90s. Cause they were sort of, I mean, I think Hellraiser was a bit earlier, but that inspiration is definitely there. As an aside, like I thought they were, I don't know if they were inspired by, but it reminded me of Doom, the game from 93, the PC game, where it was like they have like this installation on Mars and this colony, and then they accidentally open like a portal to hell and all the demons come pouring in. It's just like, oh yeah, this was like sort of a bit of a familiar story to begin with. But apparently, he was saying in those special features there, like, the original script was just calling for a lot more like traditional aliens to come through this portal. And I'm so glad they went with the demon, the hell. Like we don't know exactly what it is. I mean, when they're showing those that hellscape, is like, oh, this is kind of like a stereotypical view of like eternal suffering that we have. But they don't outright say, because there's still the sci-fi aspect of this dimension could still very well exist. And it's like that is like it's an awful place.
Yeah, because people mention hell. I think it's like the question of belief comes up, obviously, when you're dealing with these kind of entities, as it would if it would happen in real life. And some people's like, oh, like this ship has been to hell and back, I think they say at one point. But it's like,
yeah.
But then they also say it's like, oh, it's a dimension of pure chaos and pure suffering. So it's like, is it the traditional Christian version of hell, or is it just like an alternate dimension where everything just sucks? You know, it's like, it's either sci-fi. It's really cool where there's that ambiguity between the sci-fi and the supernatural. I think, like you said, like having that blend of, we've had horror sci-fi before, but typically a lot of it ends up being aliens. And so I think one of the influences that Paul W.S. Anderson, not Paul Thomas Anderson, important distinction to make.
Very important, yes.
Many of us have made that mistake in the past going down our film journeys, like very different directors. But I think one of the things the changes he made, I think he specifically called out in that documentary or that special features there, is like he wanted to make it, he was drawing on like haunted house movies, right? He wanted to make, it was like a bunch of people stuck in a haunted house dealing with the supernatural. And I was like, yeah, that's really cool. But then I also really liked about this movie, at one point, like the characters were behaving like intelligently, let's say. Like they would do this classic horror trope, was like, oh, let's split up and go like our separate ways, and they would get attacked by different stuff. But at one point, Lawrence Fishburne says, like, we're getting off this ship. It's like, fuck this ship, he literally says. And was like, we're blowing the ship up and getting out of here. It's like, I'm not staying another second. I don't care. I'm not gonna, it's like, we need to investigate this and figure out what happened. It's like, no, we're going to blow it up with the explosives and the explosives that it already has lined up in the hallway there, and like, get out of this ship. I was like, yeah. Because of course that's what you're going to do at that point. You've seen all this crazy stuff. Your buddy locked himself in an airlock and got blown out, and you see the blood coming out of his eyes and everything. It's like, it's interesting too. It's like, what's depicted, like, you know, when people go out without a spacesuit into space in different movies, a lot of it's like, oh, they're going to freeze to death or whatever. This one is in keeping with the horror theme. It's like the blood is like the pressure is going to build up and blood's going to square out your eyes, and like, your lungs are going to explode and stuff. It's like, it's fantastic. But you see all this stuff. It's like, you're seeing these visions of people's dead wives and crewmates on fire that you had to, you know, let die to save the rest of your crew. And it's like, no, I'm good. Let's get out of here. We're good to go.
Right?
I don't need any more proof.
It's important that they act intelligently like that, and they're in space, and you know the limitations. Like, you can't just walk away. They have their ship, and, you know, there's some like escape pods and stuff on there, but the event horizon is, I mean, it's that haunted house. Like, it is an entity, and it's going to prevent you from doing that. And it has the capability of like throwing horrific images into your mind, so you think you're seeing things, you do things that you wouldn't normally do. And I think that kid who I call my kid, like, I think he's the youngest crew member for the Lewis and Clark, who puts himself into the airlock. Ooh. He's basically full out possessed at that point. And right when he pushes the button to, like, you know, confirm that the airlock's gonna open in 15 seconds, he like comes to and he's just like, why am I standing here? He's like, help me. They can't do anything. That was
the
messed up
thing, because he was standing there. People were like, they were at the controls trying to like, oh, he has to open it from the inside. And they're trying to like wire it to open the doors. And he's just like looking at them, like talking to them creepy stuff. That's the other thing. It was like almost directly quoting Hellraiser. It was like, oh, I have such wonderful, wonderful things to show you. Just like Hellraiser is like, oh, we have such sights to show you. Anyway, but he's like, he's talking really creepy to them, and he goes and presses the button, and all of a sudden he's like, he snapped, like the ship releases him from its control to like let him experience the full horror of what's going to happen. It's like, that, how messed up is that? The ship is not just trying to get rid of them, but trying to inflict maximum suffering on them. I was like, he could have just like kept them, it could have just kept them possessed while he's blown up the airlock, but no, it let him, it gave him back his conscious control of his conscious faculties just for those, you know, that just for the horrific event to happen. It's like, and it, like, they see the panic in his eyes, and like, I've watching it again, I've seen this movie I don't know how many times now, but I still feel that panic. It was like, why won't you help me? What am I doing in here? What's going on? Like, that, the acting sold it. So like, the actors in this were all phenomenal as well.
Just they so did great. A really good job. Yeah. I mean, obviously you mentioned Sam Neill. He's fantastic everywhere. Lawrence Fishburne, awesome. Kathleen Quinlan, Jolie Richardson, Richard T. Jones, Jason Isaacs is in there.
Yeah, he is.
there's a lot of familiar faces, and that then I've
Sean Pertwee who I always get him confused with Jason Isaacs. They have a similar kind of face. And in this one, I think they both have buzz cuts and they're both British. So it's like, I always get those guys confused. I think Sean was in, he was in Dog Soldiers, right?
He was in Dog Soldiers. He was in Equilibrium, which is another movie that was huge for us back then.
Equilibrium.
Yeah. I'd love to go revisit that, or maybe I'm kind of scared to at this point, but
no, it's fantastic.
But the, going back to the sets for a second, one of the, like the centerpiece for me is that spinning hallway before they enter like the chamber that is like the actual jump drive itself. It's so trippy because they have the strobe lights going off. The walls seem to be spinning in like different directions. And when they go through that, like,
talking about like the meat grinder hallway. It looks the weird meat grinder,
yes.
The meat grinder hallway is spinning, but the camera is also spinning. And that because they don't have the gravity yet. So it's like, yeah, it's super disorienting. And like, it just feels like unsettling watching it, right?
Like, I remember years ago seeing quotes from Lawrence Fishburne. He was just like, he'd have to walk through that every so often. And he was just in real life getting dizzy from just walking through that set. Like it was really convincing. So it was just it was a good one there. But talking about like the special effects of that stuff, like not too bad, right? Not too bad.
They do the classic shot of somebody who's frozen and then getting shattered. And it holds up super, super well. Some of the floating objects, like, yeah, it's early CG. They did really well for early CG.
Yeah.
But like when they go in, like there's to sell the anti-gravity thing, is like, oh, they got like, you know, cups and pencils floating through the air and stuff. And it's like, okay, it's CG. But the one, you know, the heat's not on yet. So there's the one body floating around. And this, it gets me too, because it's right on the bridge, right in the area where they're walking around for most of the movie. And like the gravity goes on, this guy falls down and shatters. So you got like, and the heat's going on. So it's blood and guts everywhere. Did they clean that up? They didn't show a scene of him cleaning him up. So they're walking over this guy's blood and guts all over the floor for the rest of the movie.
Yeah. You know, that's kind of disturbing too, but it's like all the floors and stuff on these ships are just like metal grates. It's like none of them are like really solid necessarily in some, like, especially on the bridge.
Probably in case there were accidents like this. That's smart. That's smart.
Maybe they're planning ahead. It creates a certain atmosphere, especially on the bridge and whatnot, when you're just like, you have to walk with shoes in on these spaceships. Like there's no smooth surfaces.
And I love too, the feeling of kind of claustrophobia extends beyond the two ships as well, where they're in space, but they're in orbit around Neptune. So it's like all like cloudy because they're like in the atmosphere almost. So you don't actually see the stars and stuff around when they go out doing their spacewalks, when they're repairing the ship, or when people get blown out of airlocks, which happens a number of times throughout the movie, a horrific number of times. You get blown out there, but it's not like the usual kind of, you know, nice starlit sky behind you. It's like all cloudy and murky, and you can't see beyond that. And it's like even the outside of the ship, it added that sense of like claustrophobia, and that sense of, you know, like there's no escape. Even if you get outside the ship, there's no escape, right?
It's so gnarly.
Plus, one of the best lines and best line readings in all of cinema history: "This place is a tomb."
Yes. Oh my god.
That's like, oh my god, like Lawrence Fishburne, like simple line, but he imbued it with so much different, so many different emotions in that context. Like Paul W.S. Anderson was saying, you know, I think he was talking specifically about Lawrence Fishburne, but he does so much just with a look. He's just got such presence, right? It was like, he looks over and just like, he just does so much with his face. And it's like, yeah, you can see just another example of why Lawrence Fishburne is one of the all time great actors. Yeah. Like all of the things that we take for granted. And just like, he feels like the captain. He makes it feel like he's part, like, the way he interacts with the crew, like all the crew members, it feels like they've known each other for years and years and years. You know, the way he's, you know, behaving as the captain is kind of giving direction, but also being that nervous. It's like, yeah, there's like so much really nuanced performances for, you know, what could have been just a schlocky kind of B horror movie. And the actors really, all the actors, I think, really elevate this material, right?
Without a doubt. I mean, the actors probably saved the movie from like a B film like disaster, because this movie, I mean, the plot, the effects could go sideways really quickly. Like everything could go sideways. And like just you saying that line, like I'm hearing it in Fishburne's voice, be like, oh yeah, that was something where else right you, there.
Was that like a veiled criticism of my line reading?
No,
that was just dry though. But I didn't have time to rehearse that though. Give me another chance though. I was like,
no, I'm saying I could feel the power from that line be transferred through you.
Oh, I'm like, I was channeling Lawrence Fishburne. Like, he's that powerful that he makes like other people sound better. It
instantly brought me back to watching the movie and hearing that line.
Yeah, nice save, Brian.
That's exactly, no, I had no malicious intent on
I'll
that.
Take it. I'll
But also, channel some I want to talk, Fishburne. Sam Neill is absolutely fantastic. Like, I mean, obviously, Jurassic Park in 93, that's the only thing I knew Sam Neill from for a long time, because he did a lot more, like, I'd say, like, adult dramas and stuff that I wasn't experiencing. Like, you go back and watch In the Mouth of Madness, a John Carpenter film. It's like, I didn't get to experience that till later on. And I'm rediscovering all these really good Sam Neill performances that were like not child friendly. So it's like, this guy could act. To get the two of those guys together, like the cast is fantastic here. It's, as I was going to say before, the special effects do reach on that jankiness every so often. It's like, they had a nice big budget for this film. And I'm glad they focused on getting some of the actors in there as opposed to spending more and more on the sets. I mean, the sets are huge and beautiful, but some of the effects are stretched a little too far. Whereas I imagine people watching be like, oh, this looks weird, especially by today's standard. But all the practical stuff stands way up. But all the acting, you can't deny any of it. Like, just they do such a good job. And especially when you're so used to, like, the space crew. Like, the Lewis and Clark, you said it. It feels like they've all known each other before. It's like they are having a good time filming this, and they have their own personas. They have their own stories, and they have to have a bit more of it because the ghosts and weird visions they have are being pulled from their existing lives.
Yeah.
So it's like a longer cut of this movie would probably be somewhat appreciated just to get a little more backstory on some of the crew and like why these visions were just like so horrifying for them.
But I think so part of the mystique and the legend around this movie is the fact that there was a possibility for a director's cut, because I think Paul Anderson had to cut down like, was it an hour or 45 minutes out of the final cuts to get this down to whatever it was. It was out of the studio or the MPAA or whatever it was. But then the thing is, like, this footage was lost for years and years, all the cut footage. And you think, like, how can a Hollywood, big budget Hollywood movie, especially in the 90s when like you've been making movies for so long, you think like the archival process would be more formalized. But apparently all this footage was lost, but then some of it has resurfaced, but apparently in either like on like VHS or in really bad condition. So they can't actually use a lot of this stuff.
I was going to say, this is the thing. This is, so there's obviously like the regular deleted scenes and whatnot, but what we're referring to is the lost footage, like capitalize all of that, because this is legendary.
His first cut of the film. It was an actual full cut of the film with these scenes in there.
And we talked about like that hellish orgy scene of like eternal damnation. That apparently was shot by like the second unit director. And he just spent a bunch of time filming a whole bunch of stuff. And that got cut down considerably for the final film. And that's people's main focus. They want like another 5 minutes of that. And apparently it exists, but it's lost. Like the original film, all that stuff is just, you know, improperly stored, or because, you know, that's the crazy part. It's like they just stored it and they didn't take care of it because it's deleted footage and the movie's done, right? But that is what people are after. And when I looked into it, I think it was around 2010, 2011, there was a rumor that somebody had a VHS of the original first cut of the film, including all that extended footage. And Paul Anderson was like, oh, I'm going to go check this out. And we didn't hear anything else until 2017. He was asked in another interview, what happened to that VHS? He said, oh, the guy moved out of country. He never got a chance to see it, but he hopes to see it one day. And fast forward again a little bit, we have some of these boutique Blu-ray labels like Scream Factory here releasing Event Horizon, and everyone's thinking they found the footage, right? This is going to be a huge release. And I could be misremembering this. I thought they delayed the release of this on Blu-ray because and the rumors got like spun up even more, but they couldn't get the footage. I don't think they even had the footage. It was just gone. If they have it, it is beyond repair. They can't do anything. I like to think if they actually found it, they would have put it in whatever state it was in on the Blu-ray, but we don't get some kind of special feature. It just seems to be gone completely.
I was hoping for like, so there's a bunch, apparently there's a bunch of weirdos out there who just want some more like murder sex stuff. But I was thinking more like, I was hoping for more like of visions for some of the other crew members, because due to the time, I think it's like really like three or four main crew members who like you see what some of their visions are, but like everyone's going a little bit crazy and they make mention of like, oh, the ship is showing us things. So what I would have liked to seen is like, oh, you know, little like snippets for each of the crew members to see what was the ship pulling from their psyche to torture them with. Right. Cause like the one, like Sam Neill's character was getting tortured with like showing him visions of his, you know, wife who as it turns out had committed suicide. You know, Lawrence Fishburne, the captain, when he was younger, he had to, you know, there was in a situation where he's like had to choose between the life of one person and the lives of like 10 people. So he had to close a door on this guy who was in fire. It was such a great speech too. It was like, there was some really great writing where it's, you know, like, have you ever seen fire in zero gravity? It's beautiful. It just rolls over itself like liquid. And I was like, that is just like, that is really, really solid writing. It's just so beautiful. But like, it was just interesting to see how it was playing on each of the characters. Like one was like using visions of her own child against her, eventually kill her. Just like really messed up stuff like this. And some of them had their eyes missing because of course, like this weird obsession with eyes, which is like, that's always the worst, especially when like people are gouging their own eyes out. It's like, that's so gnarly. But like, that's what I was hoping for in the like, not some of the sadomasochistic murder sex stuff. I was hoping more for like the psychological psychological deconstruction of the characters. keeping it classy over at the Real Film Chronicles.
As classy as we can. Yeah, you know, I'm just looking at IMDb, and it says that the original cut was running 130 minutes. He feels that Paul Anderson felt that he cut 10 minutes too much out of the movie.
Yeah,
because he cut over 30 minutes of the film. Like, we're at a 96 minute runtime on this. It's a pretty quick ride, and it for me that it kind of works. A shorter movie, but just like, it's just fired on all cylinders. Like, it doesn't really waste too much time.
This kind of the movie is still great, right?
Yeah, but I agree that like more time, like that 10 minutes probably would have really helped quite a bit. It's unfortunate that a lot of that footage is just sort of gone, and it's not something that you probably get too much anymore, where so many movies are shot digitally and they're just files on a computer, which, I mean, those could just disappear, you know, so, but if they're not backed up properly. But here you're storing reels and reels, like tons of physical object here, the film reels in like salt mines and stuff. And then this is like, there's some kind of weird leak and it just destroys everything. And you hear about, I think it was just a couple years ago, I don't know if it was a Warner Brothers like warehouse caught fire. And in that warehouse were like a bunch of master audio tapes and reels of like
big news,
music
big
and stuff.
Weren't there a bunch of musicians who were banding together like sue Warner Brothers over that?
Yeah, yeah.
There was a huge fallout from that, right?
I don't know what happened or like the details of that, but it's like, yeah, even like that master stuff, there's a certain cost to maintaining that. And when you have a company like Warner Brothers right now who's kind of trying to cut back on all their costs,
say, like, you know, maybe our tip to Warner Brothers is maybe don't start cutting costs with the fire suppression systems and the fire alarms. Maybe that's not the first place you should start cutting costs. That's just our tip. That's our free tip from Warner Brothers.
We're no experts, but I think we're onto something there. Oh my goodness. It was interesting that documentary behind the scenes footage, Paul Anderson was talking about. He directed Mortal Kombat, right? The video game adaptation in 95. And it was a huge success. They gave him a bunch of money to do this. Event Horizon, I think of that documentary, is just like, they just about cut me a blank check to do whatever I wanted. $60 million went into this movie. And
every penny shows, by the way. Like, it looks really, really, aside from some of the, you know, some of the special effects, like you were saying, is like, yeah, of course, it was the early days of CGI, but like, it was, other than that, like the sets look really good. Like all the costumes were amazing. Like the spacesuits, like they put so much effort into that. The actors were really great. Like it was, they put so much thought into the design of the set, like you were saying, with, you know, taking like the religious elements and like repurposing them and like twisting them around. It's like that $60 million shows, man. That was, yeah, 100%.
And the box office on this film was $42 million worldwide. It was a bit of a bomb for sure. And it's like, now you can see, I mean, in the years afterwards, it's probably done quite well on home video releases, DVDs, Blu-rays. I think both of us just grabbed it on 4K just before recording this. As we watched the 4K version of this, that was a nice treat. Yeah, but I'm glad it's reached some cult status, and I'm glad it's has some people backing it and appreciating it, because I really love this movie. Like right from the get-go, it was just like I was entranced with this thing. Anything else in the movie really stood out to you here?
No, but just speaking to your point, is like it kind of bombed at the box office, but I can kind of see how, you know, it might be tough to market something like this, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's like sci-fi and horror, it's been done before with Alien, but like you have to have a proper marketing campaign to get, you know, get out to your target audience. This is one of those ones that where it straddles that line between genres.
Yeah.
Your messaging and your marketing has to be super nuanced, and you really have to, you know, think about like how you're going to target that audience and who your target audience is going to be. So like, yeah, I can see this. Like it might be tough to market something like this, right? So yeah, it's a shame that it bombed, but it's great that it's, like you said, it's finding a second life, both online and then the physical formats and finding an audience. It's, you know, that's one of the things I love about, you know, about being part of this community. You know, like you have like, you know, these cult movies, as we call them, but these kind of lesser known movies that maybe weren't as successful at the time, but because of, you know, the technology's advanced, you know, the home video market and now the online space where, you know, you build that audience up after the fact, and something that was a failure, quote unquote, a failure financially at the time it was released, can still find that audience. It's still being preserved long enough where it can find that audience and get that recognition. You know, it's great for the creators. You know, sometimes it's not great at the time when their movie, you know, doesn't make those numbers, but like it's, you know, you get to get that kind of validation later on. It's like, yeah, I was, you know, maybe I was ahead of my time, or maybe the marketing didn't quite connect with people at the time, but it's also great for, you know, I love this kind of environment, especially with the boutique labels going out and really, you know, finding these movies, you know, properly restoring them and creating that archive and giving people a chance to see these movies that we might not otherwise have seen, right? It's like, you take for granted now that, you know, Event Horizon is what now, like, almost 30-year-old movie. It's like when we were there when it came out, but like not everybody was, you know, around when it came out. Not everybody knew about it when it came out. And so like, you know, to have this community of fans building that groundswell of support, to have these boutique labels kind of listening to that and responding to that with the community, it's one of the great things where like, I'm glad that exists. It's given me so much opportunity to explore and discover new movies. I'm so pumped that, you know, Event Horizon is now part of that legion of fan films that not fan films, but fan favorite kind of cult movies that now new generations are going to be able to see, because there was that that aftershock of crowd support. And then it was picked up by, you know, different labels. I think like you said, Scream Factory did a release, and then there's this 4K release. So it's getting out there. Right. So that's always great to see. And that's always one of the, you know, one of the heartwarming stories in the community. And like heartwarming is not usually a word used to describe Event Horizon in many contexts, but this is one of those contexts.
Well, yeah, well said. I mean, I can't add much more than that, but I think now it's time for us to fully rank Paul Anderson's filmography. You know, he's done about a dozen films here. I assume you already got your list prepared there for the ranking, to see where Event Horizon lands.
Oh, I went through and watched every single movie he's ever done. Of course.
This was his third movie, it looks like. He had a movie called Shopping in 1994, Mortal Kombat, Event Horizon, Soldier with Kurt Russell, 98. Then he really got into the Resident Evil side in 2002, and also Alien vs. Predator, love it or hate it. I kind of love it now, but
Wait, he directed Soldier?
Yeah.
Oh, I love that movie.
Right? That'd be a good one to go back to.
With Paul W.S. Anderson, I'm looking at his filmography, and for me, he's so hit or miss. There's so many so many movies that I love, but then he'll just do like just wonky ones that's like did not connect with me at all.
You know, I'm looking at, I thought he did all six Resident Evil movies, but it looks like he's, you know, quote unquote, only done four of them. But, I mean, he directed the recent Monster Hunter, which was absolutely dreadful.
Wait, is he still married to Mila Jovovich?
I would assume so.
Cause I think that's, it was a great, again, love or hate their films, but it was great that he, you know, she loves working with him and he loves working with her. And like, he's putting her in all his movies. Like It's kind of nice to see that, you know? It's like a nice little.
These are family films.
Yeah, family-made films. Go see Monster Hunter and Resident Evil. Well, Resident Evil, those movies, they're all comedies, right? I caught a couple later on. It's like they seem to be turning into family-friendly comedies. So I think they're good.
Well,
for the family
now. There is a decent amount of humor in them, but maybe not so
intentional,
much on purpose.
Intentional or otherwise.
Yeah, I think they did get pretty cheesy on purpose there for a bit.
Well, I can't Nemesis look great. I'm not gonna lie. They nailed the look of Nemesis.
Oh man.
But like that's the thing. It's like Paul W.S. Anderson. Yeah, like there's some movies that I really love, and there's some I'm lukewarm on. But absolutely, you should check out his filmography. Go check it out for yourselves. I think like Event Horizon for me and Soldier. Even the first Resident Evil movie, I think there's some hidden gems in there that if you haven't checked it out, you should definitely go check out his stuff, man. There's some cool stuff in there.
Definitely. Anything else before we move on?
No, we're going to go into ratings territory here.
Oh, I forgot about ratings.
Forgot about the entire format of our podcast,
well, you know,
Brian?
I kind of thought this is more of like, you know, a look back at an older film, and it's like I didn't, yeah.
Well, we rated The Edge, right?
Did we rate The Edge?
We rated The Mummy.
Here's the thing. When we go back and cover these older movies, in my mind, we're only covering the movies we absolutely love. And like, they're all 5-star films in my mind. I don't remember if I gave The Edge 5 stars, but if I didn't, I should. Yeah. So yeah, I guess Event Horizon, what's your, we use the, just as a reminder, we use the 5-star rating system. So half star to 5 with a special like bonus on top if one so pleases. Where do you land on 5-star rating scale on this?
Yeah, so I gave Event Horizon, it's a 4.5 out of 5 for me with the heart as well. I'm making the heart shape with my hands, but only Brian can see it because we're not actually doing video.
It's very endearing. Yes, you have to trust us on this one.
Very, very heartwarming. But yeah, it's I don't know. I might bump it up to a 5 eventually. It's just a great amount of, you know, the perfect amount of sci-fi, the perfect amount of horror. The perfect amount of ambiguity as to like what's going on, and like it's just this really cool unraveling this mystery. Some, you know, jump scares that actually work and actually, you know, get me to jump, but not just get me to jump, but like it stays with me. It's unsettling and it stays with me after. Like this is one of those movies where I'm like, I have to turn the lights on before I go to bed, just like to check under my bed for evil spirits and stuff, for boogeymen and, you know,
for portals to hell,
and eyeless Sam Neill's and things like that. But what do you give this movie there, Brian?
Well, I want to talk about my journey with this film a little bit, because Letterboxd, where we rank all our movies, and I can go back and see exact dates on when I did. This is the fourth time since 2012 that I've watched this movie, I think. And the first one was in 2017. I gave it 4 stars. Okay. Then I gave it the heart bonus because I love this movie, but I realize it's not perfect. In 2021, I watched it again and I gave it 4 stars. And then I watched it last year in 2022 and I gave it 4.5 stars. So it started to improve. And on this recent rewatch, it looks like I gave it 4 stars again. So this might be stuck at 4 stars for me, but the heart was there from the beginning. I love this film. I think it's a little janky in some spots. I mean,
for sure.
We talked about where it would probably benefit from a few more minutes of character development and whatnot, but I love it. I love the concept. And this time when I was watching it, I was just kind of mulling over some of the details of like the world they're in.
Yeah.
And I love how this ship is massive. Like when they fly over to it, they're like, oh my God, the ship is huge. Like even these grizzled veterans of space traveler, like the Event Horizon was kind of a secret project that a lot of people don't know the details on, like the general public. And when these crews saw it for the first time, they're in awe. And it was really neat. And it's just like how it was designed to blow apart. They have like the explosives in this super long tunnel that connects the main jump point, or sorry, the jump drive to like the main ship part.
Those are really unique ideas. Like this fail safe built into this ship's structure is like, that's such a cool idea. So of course, if something goes wrong with the ship's drive, you blow the long corridor, and then you use the kind of the bridge and the front part of the ship is like a life raft, right? Like they said, it's like, that's really like, they actually, it was a lot of thought put into the design of this ship and all the world building, right?
Yeah. And I like even details like the captain's chair is like suspended from the ceiling instead of just being like, I'm seeing that at first be like, why? That is so weird. But you know what? They had a big budget for this movie. And I imagine that's why stuff like that happened. And Lawrence Fishburne like scoots around about a couple times on this thing. You're like, oh, I could see like some future society here making a floating chair to like better control the bridge space or something.
Professor X.
And I I watching it again, you remember the scene where he's trying to explain how like bending space just so that we're not actually traveling faster, but like we're bringing space to like two points in space to the same spot. So you just travel through the hole. And of course, Christopher Nolan's Interstellar does the exact same thing. And even when you're watching Interstellar, it's like, hey, I remember them doing that in Event Horizon like 20 years ago.
It was funny. That was the first time I'd ever seen like wormholes and like, you know, faster than light travel explained that way. It was in a schlocky sci-fi horror movie. And that was the first I've seen that as like an explanation in later, like I think Star Trek works a little bit differently because like they're bending space around them as opposed to like that's how the warp drive works. But, and again in Interstellar, but it seems to be based on some kind of, you know, some fundamental understanding of physics and how a wormhole actually was conceived. I think this is, I could be wrong, but I think that's how like Einstein would conceive the wormhole and how it would work. And it's like, oh, there's actually some real kind of science going on behind this science fiction, right? It's like, I remember the scene. That was the first time though that this weird horror sci-fi movie that I'd seen somebody explain it that with the pencil through the paper like that. It was like, in all of all places, it was an Event Horizon.
It gave so much validity to the movie when it was in Interstellar because Nolan took great pains to put the best science he could into his movie. So when they use the exact same like description of how these wormholes work, is like, oh yeah, Event Horizon. They had some real science going on in there as well. And then just throw in demons. It's great.
Okay, you got science, you got demons, you got Sam Neill and Lawrence Fishburne. Like, what more could you ask for? Go watch Event Horizon right now. Highly recommended.
As always, we appreciate you hanging out with us today and taking the time to listen to our podcast. You can find us online over at realfilmchronicles.com, where we have not just a repository of podcast episodes, but many of our written reviews as well. If you're up to it, you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram as well. All the links should be within the show notes here. So until next time, take care of yourself and others, and be sure to enjoy your film journey.